Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, hello. This episode is sponsored by iTalki, and so here is a message about them. In order to encourage you to use their services as part of your English development. So we all know a few things about learning English. Number one, if you don't use it, you lose it, so you've got to practice. Number two, the best practice that you can get is to actually engage in conversation with real people, not just doing exercises in a book or something. Number three is that you need to do it regularly, so try to make it a regular part of your routine. Number four is that it helps while you practice if you're comfortable, if you're at ease and working in a way that suits you. And with iTalki, you can do all of those things. By having lessons or conversations on iTalki, you can practice your English in a very natural way by talking to real teachers and native speakers. You can do it as often as you like. You can do it in a way that suits you personally. And also, you can do it in the comfortable and familiar surroundings of your own home, if you like, because it's all done through Skype. And remember that iTalki are offering all of you, my listeners, a free lesson. Get that offer by going to teacherluke.co.uk/talk or click an iTalki logo on my website. So, here's a new episode of the podcast. And just before we start the jingle, I just want to say that I predict that this is going to be a difficult one. I would categorize this episode as an advanced level episode, in my opinion. It's a film club episode with my brother, James, about one of our favorite films. I've been meaning to do an episode, a full episode about this film for a long time because I enjoy it so much. It's a classic of British cinema, and I want you to be able to enjoy it too. The thing is, it's notoriously hard for learners of English to understand, and it's notoriously hard to explain its appeal to those who haven't seen it. I'll explain more in the episode, but I just wanted to say, be warned, this could be quite a tricky episode, just because you'll hear my brother, our friend, and me discussing this complicated film, attempting to explain it to you, and probably making references to things that you may never have even seen. And there are a few clips from the film as well. I think this could even be more difficult than the episode that I did with my dad about the rules of cricket. But I've made an effort to make it interesting to listen to, and we're very passionate about this film. We sincerely love it, and I hope that that comes through. The whole time I was recording this, though, I was thinking, oh, this will be difficult for some of my listeners to follow. But I'm publishing it here just because I really do want to share our enthusiasm about this film with you. Even if you don't understand all of it, I still hope that you enjoy listening to us talking enthusiastically about one of our favourite things. Okay, so strap in, get ready for a difficult one, and here we go. You're listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk. Hello, folks. Welcome to another episode of Luke's English Podcast. Today on the podcast, I'm going to be talking about a cult classic of British cinema, a film called With Nell and I. This is a slightly ambitious episode because, in my experience, this film is usually very difficult for learners of English to fully appreciate. Even the title of the film somehow fails to register with many people when I tell them. For example, one of my students might ask me, can you recommend some British films? And I say, yes, definitely, you should watch With Nell and I. And the person's face creases into an expression of, what was that you just said? With Nell and I repeat. But still, this clearly just seems like a noise to this person. He doesn't know what to write. He doesn't know how many words that is, With Nell and I. He doesn't even know how to spell it. He's lost for a moment, so I write it on the board with nail and eye. Still, this doesn't help much. The person doesn't even recognise the word with nail. It's difficult to spell. It's difficult to pronounce. It doesn't seem to mean anything. And then I think, well, there's no way this guy's going to enjoy this film. He can't even get past the title. But something inside me, a voice inside me says, Luke, Luke, I am your father. No, it says, Luke, you need to make these people watch this film. It's your duty as a British person teaching people your language and culture. These people need to see this film. They need to know what a Camberwell carrot is. They need to know about cake and fine wine. They need to know why all hairdressers are under employment of the government. It's your duty, Luke, to teach these people about the wonderful world of With Nail and I, even if they don't want it. So now I feel duty-bound to tell you about this cult British film. By the way, the title of the film is With Nail and I, and these are just the two characters in the film. So there's With Nail and another guy, and he's simply referred to as I, because he's kind of the main character. If you're interested in British films, if you like slightly dark comedies with good acting, interesting characters, an excellent script, and some top-level swearing, then this film is for you. You might never have heard of it, I realise, and that's partly why I'm doing this episode. I like to recommend things that you might not know. With Nail and I is a cult film, which means that it's very, very popular with a certain group of people. It's not a mass appeal sort of film. It might not be the film that you think of when you consider typical British films. You might think of something like Love Actually or a Jane Austen adaptation. But With Nail and I is a film that you will definitely know if you're a proper lover of British films. It's a cult classic, and those who love it really love it with a passion, as if they've lived the film themselves in their own lives. But not everybody gets it. Certainly in the UK, it is very highly regarded by people who have a special love for films. But it's not a film like Four Weddings and a Funeral or James Bond, which seem to appeal to everybody. Plenty of Brits don't get this film. Also, learners of English hardly ever know about it, because in my experience, most learners of English understand British cinema as things like Hugh Grant films or Harry Potter or even Mr. Bean. It can be a difficult film to understand if you're not a native speaker from the UK. It's also not a very well-known film in the United States. But as I said, it is a cult success in the UK. Cult. So the word cult has got two meanings. It can be a noun or an adjective. The noun is basically a sort of small religious group which is devoted to a particular person. That's a cult. But then when cult is used as an adjective, for example, a cult film, then it means that this film is extremely popular with a certain group of people. So what kinds of people like this film With Nail and I? Why do people love this film so much? What is the appeal of it? What can this film tell us about British culture? Why should you, as a learner of English, take any interest in this film at all? How can you learn some real British English from this? Let's find out answers to those questions in this episode of Luke's Film Club on Luke's English Podcast, all about With Nail and I. Now, I'm a huge With Nail and I fan, but in this episode, I'm also joined by several other With Nail fans who are very keen to talk to you about one of their favourite films. Those two fans are my brother James and his friend Will. And I just sincerely hope that we can somehow explain this film to you and its appeal, and also make this interesting for you to listen to, which might be hard considering it's basically three blokes with quite similar voices talking about an obscure film that you've probably never seen. But in any case, let's get started and let's talk to James and Will.
To a delightful weekend in the country. you are cordially invited to spend a carefree weekend in the English countryside. Bask in the warm sunshine.
We've gone on holiday by mistake.
Enjoy the rustic pleasure of country living.
It's going to be so cold in here. Like Greenland in here.
Wants to get down there and have sex with those cows.
Partake of fine varietal wine.
You're drunk.
I assure you I'm not, officer. I've only had a few ales.
Get in the back of the van!
Take lunch at a charming pub.
We want the finest wines available to humanity. We want them here, and we want them now.
Fraternize with cheery locals.
I don't care where you come from.
Ponce!
Experience culinary pleasure.
I can make it die.
There is, you will agree, something je ne sais quoi about a firm young carrot.
Fish in the region's streams.
Don't threaten me with a dead fish.
With Nil and I, a trip worth taking.
What absolute twaddle.
Hello, James and Will. How are you today?
Hello.
Hello.
I'm very well, personally.
I'm also splendid.
Very glad to hear it. So can you just tell me whereabouts you guys are and what time it is at this moment, please?
Okay, it's 8:07 p.m. on Wednesday the 15th of November.
Uh-huh.
We're sitting in my flat in South London and sitting on the sofa. I'm preparing to talk to you.
Okay, good. Now, my listeners know who you are, James, but I expect my audience don't really know Will. So, James, could you introduce Will to us, please?
I'll briefly introduce him, then he can introduce himself. So Will's a friend of mine I've known for about 12 years, would you say, roughly? We met skateboarding at Kennington Bowl in Kennington, in London, skateboarding. Mm-hmm. And we have quite a lot of stuff in common, including geeking out over with Nail and I. And Will is 32 years old. He's very good at skateboarding.
Really? How good?
I'm now speaking into the microphone. So as an Englishman, I'm not allowed to say very good. I'd have to say, oh, I just have a go. yes, Jim and I met skateboarding 12 years ago. And we've been watching films together and talking about skateboarding ever since.
Fantastic. Will, could you, and my listeners already know who he is, but could you introduce my brother to the audience as well, please?
Jim is a graphic designer and he is a long-standing supporter of the rights of skateboarders in South London. He works towards campaigning for the Stockwell Skate Park, which is a very important skate park in South London. And he's a great film buff and has been teaching me about the best films of the 20th century.
Really?
The last few years.
Has he really?
Yeah. Like he really has, yeah. I'm not making it up.
Which films has he introduced you to?
Well, perhaps I had a sheltered filmic upbringing, but recently he showed me Jaws, which I'd never seen.
Really? You'd never seen Jaws?
Indeed, I'd never seen it. And we do tend to... the French Connection, thank you.
The French Connection.
It was really good, but we do tend to engage in a bit of alcohol at the same time, so sometimes the learning doesn't go in quite as well as it could.
Have you perhaps been engaging, as you said, with some alcohol this evening already?
Indeed, yes. Just a small amount.
It's only 8 p.m.
Just the right time for ales.
On a Wednesday. So you've just had a few ales, right?
I've only had a few ales.
Okay. All right, then. So I've asked you two. Well, in fact, you two are the ones who are so keen to talk to me about With Nail and I. That's part of the reason why this episode is happening. I've been meaning to talk about this film for ages, but James has pestered me a little bit to talk about it, and I'm actually very glad to do that. So we're going to talk about this film with Nail and I. Now, I need to establish, first of all, that you two are sort of worth listening to on this subject. So what are your credentials when it comes to talking about this film? Why should we listen to you two in particular about this one?
This is James here. I've watched it a lot of times. I studied film at university, film criticism. Not that that really makes a big difference, but it can help you decipher films or want to decipher films or watch them more than once. Don't know. I don't really have any credentials, man.
Okay, you just seen
Will's
the film.
Will's got some. Will's got a BA, an MA, and is a BMF besides. Is Will Kramer.
So he's well qualified.
I don't actually know what that stands for. But, anyway.
BA, Bachelor of Arts, MA, Master of the Arts, and what is it? What's the other one?
BMF.
Bad motherfucker.
Yes.
Okay, that's the BMF.
I also have a Master of Science, but none of those are in film. My credentials with regard to this film are that I've read every book about the film. There aren't that many. There's about four.
Uh-huh.
But I've bought them all and read them all carefully. And I suppose another credential is that I correspond regularly with the biggest fan of this film on the planet, whose name is Heidi, and she runs the Wall of Withnail website, which you can easily find if you Google that.
What is the Wall of Withnail website then?
She collects objects as close to resembling those that appear in the film in any scene, including if they appear for 1 second in the background. And her obsession with the film is, I think, unparalleled.
Yeah,
and to be celebrated.
So, for example, if there's a clock on the wall in the pub where they're drinking, and it's shown in the background for a second, she needs to get that clock or something that looks identical to that clock for her collection. That's how obsessed she is about this film.
That's exactly
you'll
listen
it. To this, right?
I believe she would listen to this as well.
Really?
Because it relates to the film, and if she does, hello Heidi.
Hello Heidi. So I mean, that's just an example of well, I guess you're connected to her, so you're a big fan, and that just shows also how much people are sort of so enthusiastic about this film. It's described as a cult film. I suppose that's fair, because you know the people who love it really, really love it, and it's not something that absolutely everybody knows about. All right, so we need to get into the film. What is this film all about? Could you just give us the basic details, do you think? How would you summarize it? And I'm going to say spoiler alert. We might mention some parts of the plot, but I don't think it spoils the enjoyment of the film. In fact, the real enjoyment of watching this film is seeing it again and again and again over and over. And it doesn't matter if you know what the plot is. It's more about other things. So, spoiler alert, but I don't think that's a big problem if you haven't seen the film. We shouldn't spoil it. In fact, we should help you appreciate it even more. So, what's it all about?
Indeed, it doesn't have a plot that can be spoiled. I believe it's about two out-of-work actors in 1969 in London who are struggling with their dependence on alcohol and drugs, and want to try and get away for a while to the countryside in the north of England, in Cumbria, and have a rest and feel better. And that all goes a bit wrong, because the cottage that they stay in is owned by the uncle of the eponymous Withnail, who is one of those two out-of-work actors. And the uncle quite fancies the eponymous eye, and drives up in the night to visit them. And it's a rather hilarious but difficult to summarize trio of doom. And then they come back to London, and the frayed edges of the plot happen there. But as you said, it's about watching again and again, and there's a lot to do with enjoying the characters and what they say rather than what happens. Exactly.
So it's not really about the plot. It's more, as you said, the characters and what they say. Okay. Actually, this question, is this a comedy?
Okay. It is a comedy, definitely. It's just a very dry comedy of sort of pain, really. It's not like they're all having a good time and laughing all the time. They're actually in misery. And it's their predicament that's funny for some reason, because you sort of empathize with them. And it's just very funny the way they deal or don't deal with difficult situations.
What is it about the predicament of an out-of-work actor? Is there something inherently ridiculous or funny about that?
It's the kind of clash between an ego of an actor thinking you're the greatest person and you want to stand up and perform in front of the room, but also having a sort of, I'd imagine, a crushing sort of insecurity, which is also driving that, like actors talk about sometimes. And it's the struggle of the sort of when you're young, of a certain age, and you don't really know what you're doing.
Right.
And it's not funny in a sort of cheesy comedy kind of laugh every 5 seconds. Well, there is a laugh every 5 seconds, but not in an obvious way.
Okay. When was it made?
1986.
Seven.
1987.
Okay. And when is it set?
It's set in 67, isn't it?
69. Okay.
Sorry, go on.
What was the title mean? What does the title of the film mean?
The title refers to the surname of one of the main characters. Withnell is the surname of one of the main characters, and I is the name of the other main character. His actual name is Marwood. That's his surname.
Mm-hmm.
But he's the guy that narrates, so he gives a voiceover at times. So he is the kind of I, and that comes from the fact that it was adapted from a novel. So the title is about the two main characters, the two out-of-work actors.
All right, and it was directed by Bruce Robinson, who sort of went on to become a screenwriter, and he did things like The Killing Fields and some other work like that.
The Rum Diary recently. He came out of retirement to make The Rum Diary with Johnny Depp and that Amber, what's her name?
Amber Heard, yeah.
And I quite like that film, although it's not considered to be that successful.
Mm-hmm. It's similar, isn't it, to this one in a way?
He also has some experience as an actor. He was in Zeffirelli's 1960s Romeo and Juliet. And so perhaps, no, not perhaps, I do know, he was indeed at times an out-of-work actor. So this is an autobiographical film to some extent.
Mm-hmm. Okay. I'm just wondering at this point, right, I feel like the attention of my listeners is, I'm always aware of this, right? And so
we're being really boring, aren't we?
We've explained the film, right? We've explained.
Let's talk
is.
About a bit about the background of how it got made. So it got part funded by George Harrison of the Beatles through Handmade Films.
Mm-hmm.
He pulled a lot of strings to allow this film to happen. It was made on a very low budget. And there's also quite a lot of good music in the film, which apparently he managed to get hold of, which a normal film wouldn't have been able to get, like the Beatles and Jimi Hendrix are both in this film, both of which are very hard to get, apparently, for a movie, especially a low-budget movie. So George Harrison made this film happen in lots of different ways. So that's quite an interesting backstory. And you've got some information about that, haven't you?
But, I mean, before we get into that, though, we need to actually know why this is any good. Like, why should anyone actually care about what you're saying? I mean, we get it, like, you love a film. I do too. But why is this of any interest to my audience? You know? What's the appeal? Well,
I think the appeal is proven by the fact that it's so quotable, as you've already mentioned earlier. But why it's quotable is, I think, rather subtle and possibly difficult to account for. But it must be well written, and certain things really key into deep experiences that we've all had. We've all been in our 20s. We may not have, well, not everyone has, but everyone gets to be young and possibly unsure about their futures. And it keys into a lot of these things. Another big theme in it that's dealt with really interestingly is social class. There are lots of quotes about that. It's difficult to account for how good it is. It's very subtle.
Well, can I ask us to think about this? Like, how does the film actually open? What's the opening scene of the film? And how does that kind of set the scene for the rest of the movie?
You meet someone in a very bad state of mind. And they're extremely anxious, extremely stressed. And they're trying to sort of somehow hold it together. And you realize they're living in complete squalor, complete mess. This is the disgusting filth.
This is the eye character. We start the film with him smoking a cigarette and sitting there looking very anxious, and you don't know what time of day it is.
You don't know what's going on. It seems like dawn.
It's like first thing in the morning, and you realise that he's been up all night, and he's in a real state of mind, and he puts the kettle on, and he's very confused, and then he decides to go outside, and he has a sort of a panic attack, stressing out about his predicament. And the fact that they haven't got any work. And then he comes back, and that's when we realise that he's living with this other guy called Withnell, and he seems to be a bit of a handful. And then we get our first introduction to Withnell, and immediately he starts quoting, well, he's not quoting lines, he's just saying, you know, the lines in the script, but they're all incredibly memorable, quotable lines. What are some of the lines he says at the beginning there?
I think the opening line is, "Do you want a cup of tea?"
Right. Classic.
And then he starts, I don't know, I'm going to hand over to Will for a bit of...
Okay. Well, I says, "My thumbs have gone weird." As you said, he's having a panic attack, and he explains to his flatmate, Withnell, that his thumbs have gone weird.
"It's a nightmare, I tell you. It's a nightmare.
We've just run out of wine. What are we going to do about it?"
I don't know. Oh, God, I don't feel good. My thumbs have gone weird. Oh, God. My heart's beating like a fuck clock. I feel dreadful. I feel really dreadful."
"So do I. So does everybody."
It's kind of relevant that it's the end of the 60s. It's like the party has just finished. The whole 60s party has just come to an end in that moment. And he's left shivering, cold and freaked out in a broken flat, and it's quite scary. It's not particularly funny,
because the 60s was very idealistic and also hedonistic as well. So it was like this big sort of party, this thinking that they were going to change the world, and drugs were a part of that. And then they just emerged at the end of that decade, rather than liberated, they were just all messed up and paranoid. And so it's kind of about the end of an era, isn't it? And the end of innocence, both for the context of the time and for the character in the film, who realizes he has to kind of move on and grow up and sort of leave certain things behind.
They're living in Camden, which is a pretty nice place now, but in those days, probably pretty rough. And everywhere is just threatening and nasty and, you know, old school. It feels like a big age divide, big age gap between every time they go to the pub, there's all these old geezers in there who hate them because they dress like twatty actors. And it's just like the whole world's against them, really.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. In the area where they live, it's all these working class Irish immigrants who are all really rough guys and, would always sort of threaten to fight them and things like that. And there's a scene in the film where they go to the pub and there's a rough... Irish guy who threatens them, and Withnell is hilarious in the way that he responds, like a total coward. So that kind of brings us to the characters, really. So they're these two actors out of work, they're sort of mentally on in a weird state, and they're a bit desperate and paranoid, but there's a difference in the characters, right? And this is really where the interest in the film is, the way that the characters react and interact with each other. So how would you describe Withnell, the character of Withnell, then? Because he's a fascinating character, played brilliantly by Richard E. Grant, the actor. But tell us about Withnell.
Withnell is of a middle or upper social class, and
he's upper class,
yeah,
really
upper Def- class upper okay class. Yeah, and he has a posh accent, therefore, and he's very convinced of his talent and his good looks as well, but he's quite ruthless. He's willing to lie even if it harms his best friend. He's also willing to lie for alcohol or drugs. He's very interested in alcohol and drinks as much as he can of it.
In fact, this is what motivates him, it seems, really. It's that and just the blind sort of assumption that he's going to become a huge star, even though the whole time he's treating everyone like shit and just drinking all the time. and in this constant party. But there is something hilarious and ridiculous about Withnall. I mean, he's an awful person. Absolutely awful. But, I mean, why would anyone spend time with him?
Well, he has a certain charisma and he's sort of compelling in that way. And he isn't always being awful. He's often making pronouncements about things in a very witty way. And I believe he was based on a man called Vivian McCarroll, an alcoholic, out-of-work actor who was equally compelling, dishonest and charismatic, all bundled in together.
And so what about the other character, I? He's really based on Bruce Robinson, the writer.
Yeah, I's like Bruce's character. He's sort of more middle class. So he kind of looks up to Withnall and his sort of arrogance.
Mm-hmm.
And Withnall's also very funny and dry and, you know, kind of dominates the room. But I's a bit more shy, a bit more unself-assured. He doesn't really know how to deal in sort of upper-class circles. Mm-hmm. He's a bit more in touch with reality, though, somehow. He can relate to normal people a bit better than Withnall can. And he's just very shy, very paranoid, quite earnest. You know, he's kind of like the guy you empathize with, I suppose.
Yeah.
He's the narrator, although the narration kind of fades out halfway through the film and it just sort of stops.
It does, doesn't it?
And the narration is very, very patchy because to start with, it's like, oh, this is weird. This guy's like talking over it. It's like his thoughts
mm-hmm.
when he's in the cafe and stuff. And then... Yeah. Kind of goes away a bit.
It does.
I think it comes back at the end a little bit.
Yeah, it does.
Or does it?
So you've got. See, I don't think it does. I don't think it does.
No, I think it just goes away, which is kind of weird.
So the like voiceover narration in the first sort of half an hour of the film, and then it goes away. But so we've got these two characters: one who's kind of a bit sort of shy, a bit unsure of himself, but he's got potential. And then you've got Withnall, who's absolutely convinced in of how brilliant he is, and he's this sort of charismatic figure, but he's utterly self-interested. And he just cares about pleasing himself all the time. And as you said, he's prepared to lie if it means kind of getting what he wants, which is basically comfort and booze. And so how does this play out then over the course of the film? How does this kind of get them into certain scrapes then?
Well, they go on holiday.
Why do they go on holiday? Because that's the first thing.
Because they want to... It's I's idea. And he says, why don't we get out of it for a while? You know, and there's a few jokes about that. And why don't we get into the countryside? And he says, what about your thingy with the cottage? And he's like, why don't you give him a ring? He's like, who the fuck are you talking about?
Well, man, what's his name?
What about him?
Why don't you give him a call?
What for?
Ask him about his house.
You want me to call what's his name and ask him about his house?
Why not?
All right, what's his number?
I've no idea. I've never met him.
Well, neither have I. What the fuck are you talking about?
Your relative with the house in the country.
Monty. Uncle Monty.
It's him. That's the one. Get the jag fixed up. Spend the week in the country.
All right. Give us a tenner and I'll give him a bell.
Here. Get a couple more in. Go for a smash.
He says, what about your thingy with the cottage? And he's like, why don't you give him a ring? He's like, who the fuck are you talking about? They're just having nonsensical conversations. Anyway, what am I talking about?
You're talking about why it is that they first go away on holiday. And I think it's because I says, your uncle's got a house in the countryside. And Withnall's like, all right. And he calls him. But we don't realise until later how Withnall has managed to persuade Uncle Monty to let them have the cottage. We don't know. It's just a secret. They go round to his house, and Uncle Monty is this incredibly posh person. He's also really camp, basically like sort of obviously gay, and this huge physical presence as well. He's a big sort of fat guy, and played by, what's the name of the actor?
Richard Griffiths.
Richard Griffiths, a fantastic British actor who's been in a number of other things. He was in Harry Potter, famously. Anyway, he's this big guy, this incredibly camp uncle of Withnall's, and he obviously takes a fancy to I, and I is completely freaked out by him.
Oh, hello! Come in.
Sit down.
Do.
Would you like a drink?
Sherry.
Sherry. Sherry?
Sherry.
Sherry. Do you like vegetables? I've always been fond of root crops, but I only started to grow last summer. I happen to think the cauliflower more beautiful than the rose.
Chin chin.
Do you grow...
geraniums.
Oh, you little traitors. I think the carrot infinitely more fascinating than the geranium. Mm. The carrot has mystery. Flowers are essentially tarts. Prostitutes for the bees. Mm. There is, you will agree, a certain je ne sais quoi, un thing very special about a firm young carrot. Mm. Excuse me. Do help yourself another drink.
That's all this. The man's mad.
Eccentric. Eccentric. He's insane. Not only that, he's a raving homosexual.
But Withnell goes away into a room with Uncle Monty and does this deal where they get the cottage. He comes downstairs with the key and he says to Marwood
that... free to those who can afford it. Very expensive to those who can't.
Yeah, free to those who can afford it, very expensive to those who can't. What does that tell you?
A very, very true statement.
What does that tell you about class? Anything?
Well, absolutely. People of a very upper class persuasion or birth will often get things that are expensive to anyone else for free in the manner that celebrities sometimes do at pubs. Or clubs, they get free drinks just to be in there.
That's right.
But I wonder if we can spoil the plot a little bit and explain what it turns out. Withnail has told.
I don't know. Maybe we could spoil the plot there. Or should we wait until later? Anyway, maybe we'll wait.
I think we need to come up with some quotes.
Well, okay. Look, we need to start. No, not yet.
We need to make this funny because I don't feel we're winning anyone over.
Yeah, we're not at all. But no quotes yet. We need
is anyone still listening? I'm sorry.
That we need to establish what the drama is in the story because otherwise there's no point to this at all.
Well, it's so, really funny. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, but why?
They go away to this cottage. The cottage is an absolute shithole. They can't even get there because they're in a one-eyed jag.
What's that?
It's a Jaguar car, British, old British car, completely battered with only one headlight working, and it's pissing it down with rain. And Withnell's absolutely pissed out of his head.
Drunk.
On port that he's nicked from Monty's house. And they have a complete nightmare getting there. They finally get there in the middle of the night in the pouring rain. Withnell's half dead. They manage to get in the cottage. They've got nothing to eat. They've got nothing to light a fire with. They're just fucked. And Withnell sits down and Marwood says, "What are you doing?" And Withnell says, "I'm sitting down to enjoy my holiday."
Right. And in the end, they work it out, but it's like these two guys who've gone on holiday by mistake. That's the kind of funny line in it, isn't it? That they end up trying to get the attention of one of the farmers from a local farm. And they're like shouting at him, you know, "Oh, we've come on holiday by mistake. Are you the farmer?" And having a big argument.
"Stop, please. Please stop. Please stop. Are you the farmer?"
"Shut up. I'll deal with this.
We've gone on holiday by mistake. We're in this cottage here. Are you the farmer?"
"Stop saying that, Withnell. Of course he's the fucking farmer. We're friends of Montague Withnell. We desperately need fuel and wood. Montague Withnell. You must know him. Fat man, owns the cottage."
"Ah, say the fat man. London type, queer sort. Think his name's French or something."
"French?"
"Aye, Adrien de la Touche. He ain't been here for a couple of years. Last time I saw him, he was with his son."
"Yeah, that's him.
Listen, we're bona fide. We're not from London. Could we have some fuel and wood?"
"I could bring you some logs up later, but I've got the cows and that to feed first."
"When?"
"Shut up!
That would be very kind."
I feel like this should be just a brief intro and then you just play the film.
The whole thing should just
But
be...
how do we make this funny? I mean, we're not getting it across. Well, what do they do in the documentaries? They quote all the lines.
The thing is, the documentaries is it's for the people who've already seen the film. And it's...
fucker said that?
You can't just repeat all the quotes because no one's going to know what any of them mean. All we have to say is that you should watch this film because it's good. And that's it, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm trying to think of a quote that works on its own.
We want the finest wines available to humanity. We want them here and we want them now. That's probably the most fair. Can I ask you actually first, before we go into all that stuff? Right. So talking about the appeal of the film, the appeal of this might not be obvious to the people who haven't seen it, which is the problem we're having. Here's what my wife thought when I showed her this film. So she thought it was boring and depressing. She said the characters are miserable, the colours are all washed out, nothing happens, everything's grey, okay? Which is not an uncommon reaction, because I've shown the film to several groups of learners of English, you know, advanced ones, and the response was often muted. I don't think they really got it. The language is very hard. It's very sort of wordy, very reliant on the script. And also, there are certain other things that don't help it to satisfy a broad audience. Like, it doesn't actually have any romance in it. There's no love interest. It doesn't contain any obvious jokes. They're not obvious ones. It's not very brightly lit or colourful. It's like you would find in a rom-com. There's not really any action, maybe a little bit. The characters are often quite hysterical and over the top. There's a lot of very colourful language and swearing. It's set in the past. Nothing really seems to happen. And there are no female characters in it. So, that's what people often seem to think when they come to it cold. How did you first discover the film? And when you first watched it, did it immediately strike you as being a classic?
No. And I think that's a rite of passage for everyone that sees this film. Perhaps the problem is there's a tradition in England of watching this film at university or when you're young, and someone possibly a bit older than you, maybe just a year or two, who's seen it a couple more times, persuades you that there is something good in there. I think it's a bit like drinking whiskey. At the first taste, it often just seems like it tastes like smoke. And you think, well, why is there such a cult following of this drink? Who would care about this? And then you drink it and somebody starts telling you, look at the subtlety of the, on the edge of that flavor of smoke, there's vanilla, there's this, there's that, there's the other, there's a hint of all that. And I think it's similar. I remember watching it and not quite getting what all the fuss was about.
Yeah.
But by the time I watched it the third time, my flatmate had convinced me that there was stuff to look out for, and that it was the subtle depth of the lines and the penetrating sagacity of
sagacity.
I don't even know what that means.
It means depth of understanding, perspicacity.
But it's interesting. Wow. It's interesting to hear about how you first came across the film. What about you, James? How did you first discover it?
Luke, did we watch it in Chadwick End?
Let's see. So I remember.
I think I had seen it when I went to university once.
Yeah, I think you had, because this is what happened.
Maybe twice. Even.
As with most things in your life, I remember them better than you do.
Yeah, that's why I'm asking.
These are events in you. Like, when you can't remember something in your life, you ask me. Like, Luke, where was I living in 1999? And I'll be like, oh, yeah, you were in Sheffield. Oh, yeah, that's it. I bet you couldn't even remember where you were living in 1999. Anyway,
sorry, mate.
Anyway, so here's what happened. Here's how I discovered it, and I think it may be the same
time.
It's the same time you discovered it. So,
but basically, I was going to say I'd seen it once. Oh, go on, then. Go on, do your bit, because it's the same. We watched it together.
Yeah, I think I remember the same time we watched it, maybe together. But I was in a band at sixth form college when I was about 17. And the bass player in the band was quoting all of Danny's lines from the film. So there's the fourth character we haven't mentioned.
Yeah, Danny's a fucking gem.
Danny is the drug dealer who sells drugs to them, even though he's run out during the film until the end. But Danny's this sort of very shady character who sort of speaks like this, Danny. He's got a sort of erotic
eyes. He's got slightly soft R's when he speaks. His R's are quite soft, and he speaks in a slightly patronising way.
He speaks in a very sort of matter-of-fact, very slightly patronising way with these slightly erotic R's.
So, Luke, the thing you have to remember when you're recording these podcasts is you have to make them interesting.
Yeah, okay.
You know, that kind of thing.
So the bass player in this band kept quoting Danny's lines from the film. And the guys in the band were all laughing. And I was like, what's that? And they explained it was With Nell and I. And then I think I mentioned it to my mum. And she went out and bought With Nell and I on DVD. She's the one...
No, on video, VHS.
On video, yeah, video. She's the one who actually bought it. And then I understand, I think, that we watched it together. The three of us, mum...
I think you're right.
Mum, you and me, watched that together. And I was expecting... Because I'd heard all this stuff about the Camberwell carrot, you know. I invented it in Camberwell, and it looks like a carrot.
It resembles a carrot.
A Camberwell carrot is a really big joint, like this big spliff that Danny rolls, and it's huge like a carrot. And, you know, this joint requires up to 15 skins, right?
Do you like a smoke?
Yes.
No, thanks. I've got a call to make.
What are you going to do with those?
The joint I'm about to roll requires a craftsman. It can utilise up to 12 skins. It is called a Camberwell carrot.
It's impossible to use 12 papers on one joint.
It's impossible to make a Camberwell carrot with anything less.
Who says it's a Camberwell carrot?
I do. I invented it in Camberwell, and it looks like a carrot.
Anyway, he sort of rolls this huge joint called the Camberwell carrot. So I'd heard about this and I was expecting basically like a British version of Cheech and Chong, like a stoner comedy where they're constantly smoking massive spliffs and it's all hilarious. And so that was what I was expecting. And sort of instead, it's like this kind of slightly grim drama in some moments. And it's this quirky kind of buddy movie with these two actors who go on holiday by mistake. And there's not really a lot of drug stuff going on in most of the film until the end where the Camberwell carrot comes out. And there's a very funny scene where they smoke it and Marwood's character goes all paranoid. And then Danny starts kind of ranting about politics. And it's all very sort of evocative of those days at university where you may have smoked a Camberwell carrot and, you know, sort of started to get anxious or something. And
I think it's one of those films that shows up the sort of bullshit around drugs being great, wonderful, brightly coloured. You know, in films when they talk about LSD, it's always this amazing, like, oh, wow, flowers and, you know, peace and love and everything.
Yeah.
I think the reality for a lot of people is it's pretty grim.
Yeah, it does show the sort of the really bad side of drugs, because often in films when they have pots, you know, when there's weed, it's usually someone who kind of gets all forgetful and they get hungry and they get the munchies and it's all very ridiculous. But in this film, they smoke weed and it's like awful, like really, you know, one of them has a really bad time and he finds it really hard to kind of to deal with the intensity of it. And it's sort of like this realistic version of drugs, and it's grim and sort of hilarious, but horrible at the same time, which is probably a much more realistic depiction of what it's really like. So I was expecting this stoner comedy, and instead I got this whole other thing, and I had to watch it a few times. I don't quite know how I ended up watching it more. I think it was at university. Like you said, Will, there is a tradition in the UK. There's a whole culture of university, really, which they might not get in other countries. And the thing is that in the UK, when teenagers go away to university at 18 years old, they typically leave home and go and move to a completely different part of the country where they live in these houses with other students. So you end up with these student houses, which really resemble life in the house in With Nell and I, which is this kind of place where no one ever does the washing up. And so there might be things growing in the kitchen sink. And there might even be rats in the house somewhere, but no one's noticed. And no one cleans anything up. There's crap everywhere, and they constantly stay up all night doing things they shouldn't be doing. And typically people probably end up in the kind of condition that Marwood is in at the beginning of the film, all paranoid and washed up and without sleep. And so I think I wouldn't be surprised if there are many, many people who've lived that kind of life, that debauched life at university, away from home,
you know, doing all these sordid things and feeling bad about it, scraping through university, getting your degree, and then growing up and still loving this film because it seems to capture this weird emotional moment in our lives, which is, it's a sort of romantic thing as well. There's a lot of sort of tragedy in the film in many ways. The tragedy of this character Withnail, who's never going to amount to anything. He's just a drunk.
And that's part of the brilliant, compelling nature of the film, that it taps into this reality. You mentioned it earlier, that it has a real appraisal of what the drugs experience is like. But I think it also, in a very real way, being young, at being an actor, at being at alcohol, but also at friendship, at lying, all these things, and the fact that it's realistic rather than filmic is possibly the reason why you need to watch it more than a few times in the end to really start to grasp it. In the same way that reality is quite confusing, when you meet someone in reality, you don't come away thinking, yeah, they are, and then three adjectives about them. You have a very complex sense of them, and these characters are polyphonic in the same way. They're 3D characters that last through 50 or 100 or 300 viewings, as indeed Heidi has reached, I think.
Really? That's incredible. Yeah.
We've seen it a few times in the cinema, and we went to an outdoor screening of it as well. They did in the park.
Yeah.
I mean, it is a cult film. It does pop up on the sort of indie circuit, or whatever you want to call it, of like smaller cinemas and outdoor events and stuff.
And then it'll sell out.
And it will sell out, usually.
Yeah, I saw it outdoors as well. It was amazing. Everyone was repeating lines of the script while watching. It was like a big party in front of the screen. It was amazing.
The first time I saw it, I liked it. I thought it was felt more of a sort of grim, gritty drama than a comedy.
Yes, that's how I felt.
And the second time I saw it with sort of student friends, and it seemed a bit more laughable, and you kind of knew what was coming. And then I kind of went off it for a while, and then got it on DVD, and then kind of rediscovered it.
Mm.
And it doesn't get old. I mean, I watch a lot of comedy films. Someone said, I think it was Adam and Joe, they were saying, even Spinal Tap, there's only so many times you can watch that before it kind of gets a bit too much.
That's another film.
With Nell and I, you can really watch it a lot and still get stuff out of it.
Mm, okay.
I'd agree with that. And I would like to make a case in point about that, because at a certain point fairly recently, maybe a couple of months ago, Jim and I had watched the film, we thought, too many times.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd been to see it in the cinema for its 30th anniversary showing. And then we saw it for another 30th anniversary showing outdoors in a park somewhere. And then I was requesting that we watch it again at home at Jim's house. And he said, we've overdone it. And I don't think it was more than a fortnight later, 2 weeks later, before we watched it again, and he shook his head solemnly and said, it just is that good. It keeps going.
So what are some of your favorite moments from the film?
Well, for me, I think the finest moment, and possibly one of the only moments that might work without knowing the film at all, is when Monty says, I can't touch meat until it's cooked. As a youth, I used to weep in butcher shops.
Yeah, it's a moment in the kitchen when he's asking Marwood to prepare the meat. He's like, I can't touch meat, right? As a youth, I used to weep in butcher shops.
Now, garlic, rosemary, and salt. I can never touch meat until it's cooked. As a youth, I used to weep in butcher shops.
It's almost a joke in itself. But this is the thing about this film. It resists having any one-liners that really are jokes in their own right. It's very character-based.
I think the one scene that stood out for me at the beginning, and I think this is probably the most famous scene in the film, is when they're drunk in a very posh little town in Penrith, and the both of them are completely pissed. And they've been sent into town on an errand by Uncle Monty, and they like balls to the errand, and they go and get pissed instead. And they go in, as they emerge from the pub, they see a little shop that sells cake and tea. And one of them's like, we need to go in there, don't we, and get some cake, soak up the booze. And so they turn up in this very posh little cake shop where there are, you know, very nicely dressed people sitting down. It's all sort of old, retired, posh people. And they turn up all drunk and looking like a couple of sort of, I don't know what they look like. They look a real mess. And they immediately
farmhands.
Yeah, they demand immediately to have cake and wine. We want the finest wines available to humanity. We want them here and we want them now. That's probably the most famous line from the film, isn't it? They demand cake and wine from the old couple who are selling tea and cake.
We're early. We want to get in there, don't we? Eat some cake, soak up the booze. All right, chair.
What do you want?
Cake. All right, chair.
No, we're closing in a minute.
We're leaving in a minute. One. Cake and tea.
Didn't you hear? She said she'd closed. What do you want in here?
Cake. What's it got to do with you?
I happen to be the proprietor. Now, would you leave?
Ah, I'm glad you're the proprietor. I was going to have a word with you anyway. We're working on a film up here. Location, see. We might want to do a film in here.
You're drunk.
Just bring out the cake. Cake and fine wine.
If you don't leave, we'll call the police.
Balls. We want the finest wines available to humanity. We want them here, and we want them now.
Miss Blenner has it. Telephone the police.
It's all right. Miss Blenner has it. I'm warning you. If you do, you're fired. We are multi-millionaires. We shall buy this place and fire you immediately. Yes, we'll buy this place. And we'll install a fucking jukebox in here. Life and all you stiffs up a bit.
The police, Miss Blenner, has it. Just say there are a couple of drunks in the Penrith tea rooms and we want them removed.
We are not drunks. We are multi-millionaires.
Hurry up, Mabs. We'll keep them here till they arrive.
It won't keep us anywhere. We'll buy this place and have it knocked down.
Right. Please.
Right. We're going. Our car's arrived. We'll be back. We're coming back in here.
And the old couple are like, we don't have any wine. Look, just, no, now get out. We're closing. We're leaving in a minute, you know, all that stuff. And
they threaten to call the police and Withnail. And no, I claims that they're millionaires. And in fact, that, you know, there's no need to call the police. They're leaving in a minute.
And then the Rolls Royce turns up and they actually do leave.
And after all this palaver where they're claiming to be multimillionaires, a Rolls Royce Silver Ghost, I think. Heidi, you'll know. Rolls up and they go, it's all right, our rider's here. And they leave in a
Rolls
Royce.
We're coming back in here. Yeah. I mean, also, it's the performance of Richard E. Grant as this drunk, posh, drunk sort of buffoon, prancing like a tit.
There's an interesting thing. That point, I think, that point in the film is particularly celebrated because it's very odd. He seems to be laughing uncontrollably, but in a very unusual way. And I think most people find that very compelling. I do too, but the real reason behind it apparently was that there were some very small dogs in the laps old women who were sitting in the cafe that were sniffing like this. And he thought, and Richard E. Grant, the actor, thought that those women were laughing at the acting he was doing. And it was setting him off to laugh. And so he couldn't stop laughing. And they did the take many, many times. And in the end, they went with the one that you see in the film.
Oh, I see.
Where he's laughing through the lines. And that's added a special je ne sais quoi, oh, so very special to the film.
Okay. Will is quoting a few lines from the film as we go on. That's the thing, isn't it? It's incredibly quotable. Like all the lines from the film, you can sort of repeat them with your friends and it kind of immediately raises a laugh because it sort of just brings to mind the scenes and the characters in the film. And the lines, refer to many different things. I mean, there's a Facebook group called the Withnail and I Appreciation Society. And basically what people do on that Facebook group is they post things and then everyone just writes in the comments section, they just write quotes from the film. And it's surprising.
We will sometimes try and communicate entirely in Withnail and I quotes.
Yeah.
We've sometimes someone will send the other one a text. And they can't, personally, I see it as a challenge to try and come up with a quote, however obscure, from the film that fits that situation.
What's your favorite? So
basically every single line is quotable.
What's your favorite line? Can you explain the context in which it occurs?
That's tough because whatever comes into your mind is just an obvious one, but there's lots.
I'm fond of a lot of the things.
I think the confrontations are quite good between, like, what fucker said that?
So that's where they go into the pub.
Because it's just preceding a big fall, it's like the pride before a fall.
Yeah, well, so what happens is that at one point, Withnail vomits all over Marwood's shoes, and Marwood, in order to cover up the smell of the vomit, is forced to use essence of petunia, which is kind of a sweet-smelling sort of stuff. It smells a bit like perfume. And then they go to one of these rough pubs with all these rough guys in it, and at one point, as Marwood is walking back from the loo, one of these guys shouts at him and calls him a perfume ponce. A ponce is like a sort of it's a word for a gay, right? It's a sort of abusive word meaning gay. And perfume ponce. And Marwood gets all freaked out and scared, and he goes back to Withnail at the bar, and he goes up to him and he goes, "I've been called a ponce." And he's sort of all paranoid. And Withnail immediately goes, "What fucker said that?
Perfume ponce."
"You'll be pleased to hear Monty's invited us for drinks."
"Balls to Monty, we're getting out."
"Balls to Monty? I spent an hour flattering the bugger."
"There's one over there that doesn't like the perfume, a big one. Don't worry. We're in danger. We've got to get out."
"What are you talking about?"
"I've been called a ponce."
"What fucker said that?"
"I called him a ponce. And now I'm calling you one. Ponce!"
"Would you like a drink?"
"What's your name, Mac? Fuck!"
"I have a heart condition. I have a heart condition. If you hit me, it's murder."
"I'll murder the Perius!"
"My wife is having a baby." "Listen, I don't know what my acquaintance did to upset you, but it's nothing to do with me. I suggest you both go outside and discuss it sensibly in the street."
And then immediately this huge guy comes up and goes, "I called him a ponce, and now I'm calling you one, ponce." And Withnail crumples like a coward, and he's immediately like, "My wife is having a baby. If you hit me, it's, you know," and he's like, "Well, I have a heart condition. I have a heart condition. If you hit me, it's murder." And immediately comes out with all these ridiculous excuses and things. And it just shows how pathetic Withnail is. You know, on one hand, all this bravado of like, "What fucker said that?" And then immediately, as soon as he's challenged by this guy, he's like, I have a heart condition. If you hit me, it's murder.
My favorite line might be, tactical necessity.
Calculated risk.
Calculated risk, tactical necessity.
You're gonna have to explain that, though.
It says it's so offhand.
Well, now that I can explain that, it's going to be a plot ploiler.
Spoiler alert!
A plot spoiler.
Yeah. Go on.
It turns out that Monty has driven all the way up to the cottage that he owns, where the two main characters are staying with Noah and I, because he's interested in sleeping with I. And this becomes clear to I when he finds himself a man naked in a corner. And there's a fairly predatory scene, but it's dissolved eventually.
Well, he thinks he's so freaked out by the fact that Monty's coming onto him that he promises, you know, he makes Withnell promise that he can sleep in the room with the lock on the door. And that night Withnell gets really drunk and Monty's like, I think he should, you know, sleep in the room well, for some reason he puts him in the room with the lock, and then Marwood is cornered by Monty, who's like trying to seduce him, saying things like, are you a sponge? That's his chat.
Are you a sponge or a stone?
Are you a sponge or a stone? Then Marwood's response
is... That's an actual quote from something Franco Zeffirelli said to Bruce Robinson.
When he was trying to seduce him.
When he did seduce him.
Oh, really?
He was such a bastard, Zeffirelli. I'll do this very quickly, but it's the truth. I was at drama school, came out of drama school. Next thing, I'm on a plane out to Rome. I'd never been on a jet plane before in my life. And I'm in this amazing apartment in Via Due Micelli in the middle of Rome. And I walk in there, and there are about a dozen very, very cutely dressed men with little Gucci handbags. And Franco sort of brings me in to introduce me. I'm really not homophobic, but this was what happened to me that night. And as I walk in there, these guys with the handbags, ma Franco, guarda qui, allora, incredibile. Zeffirelli says to me, oh, you must be very tired. You must be very tired. You have a shower. And the next thing, I'm in the bathroom having a shower, and the fucking door opens, and there he is, standing there. I'm going to give you a kaftan. He'd just come back from Cairo. I'm going to give you a kaftan. It'll be beautiful, blue silk kaftan. Then he dries my... I put on the kaftan. Now he dries my hair. Now we go back into the room with the dozen Gucci boys, except they've all gone. And there's just me and him, and I'm on the sofa. What do you want to drink? You like something to drink? Bit of whiskey. And he leans over to me and says, are you a sponge or a stone?
Are you a sponge? That's his chat.
Are you a sponge or a stone?
Are you a sponge or a stone? Then Marwood's response
is... That's an actual quote from something Franco Zeffirelli said to Bruce Robinson.
When he was trying to seduce him.
When he did seduce him.
Oh, really? anyway, so Monty's turned up in order to... Because he's interested in Marwood. And it turns out that Withnell, when he went off into that room in order to make a deal about the cottage, apparently he promised Uncle Monty that he would be able to have his wicked way with Marwood, and that Marwood was a toilet trader.
And he'd been arrested on the Tottenham Court Road. And Monty mentions all this and explains why he's come to have his wicked way with I. And I is shocked and appalled and says, he told you that. He said I was a toilet trader. And explains that, in fact, Withnail and I are a couple. Which is in fact not true. They're just very good friends.
He says that in order to get away, to get out of this potential buggery in the bedroom from Uncle Monty. He spins this story out of desperation that him and Withnail are actually a couple, and
it works. And when he returns to Withnail, Withnail is very drunk and asleep, but he wakes him up, and Withnail explains that the reason he told these he made these fabrications and told these lies about I was for tactical necessity, calculated risk. He didn't think Monty would come all this way out there. And I points out that indeed Monty, he'd go to New York.
He would.
It's no, you bastard, wake up. Wake up, you bastard, or I burn this bastard bed down.
I deny all accusations. What do you want?
I have just narrowly avoided having a buggering, and I've come in here with the express intention of wishing one on you. Having said that, I now intend to leave for London.
Hold on. Don't let your imagination run away with you.
Imagination? I just finished fighting a naked man. How dare you tell him I'm a toilet trader?
It's a tactical necessity. If I hadn't told him you were active, we'd never have got the cottage.
I'd never have wanted it, not with him in it.
I never thought he'd come all this way.
Monty, he'd go to New York.
Calculated risk.
What is all this tactical necessity and calculated risk? This is me, naked, in a corner. And how dare you tell him I love you? And how dare you tell him you rejected me? How dare you tell him that?
Sorry about that. Got a bit carried away. Sort of said it without thinking.
Well, let me tell you something, Miss Martin. If he comes into my room again, it's murder, and you will be held responsible in law.
But I like the fact that tactical necessity and calculated risk is so funny, because they're sort of like military terms, you know, yeah. Strategic military terms for something, you know, tactical.
A betrayal. Tactical, a horrible betrayal.
Tactical necessity and calculated risk. Yeah.
This is me naked in a corner.
Right. I think for me.
Also, anything Danny says is basically the best line in the film.
My favorite lines of the film are when the two of them are getting dressed to go and see Monty to go and try and get the cottage. And Danny turns up. Withnail's talking about getting his hair cut, and Danny starts pontificating about haircuts. He goes,
I don't advise a haircut.
I do not recommend a haircut, man. All hairdressers are under employment of the government. This is his conspiracy theory. They transmit signals from the cosmos and send them directly to the brain. This is why bald men are uptight. And with Nell's response,
I can confirm that.
I don't advise a haircut, man. All hairdressers are in the employment of the government. Hair are your aerials. They pick up signals from the cosmos and transmit them directly into the brain. This is the reason bald-headed men are uptight.
What absolute twaddle.
Yeah, so everything that Danny says is hilarious. His conspiracy theories and his sort of political ramblings and stuff.
And it's just his voice is just so amazing.
This sort
If I medicined you, you'd think a brain tumour was a birthday present.
So I think maybe we can just wrap this up by saying...
We haven't convinced anyone, have we?
No, not at all.
Difficult language as well, I'd imagine.
Absolutely.
Especially some of the words that Will used. Because, I mean, that's just, you know, that's just being difficult on purpose.
Showing off.
Is there a word for that, being difficult on purpose?
Obscurantism.
Really?
Told you it was a BMF, didn't I?
Yeah. I think the fact that the film is so quotable is a good thing for learners of English, because, I mean, if these lines stick in your head that easily, I think that... All the listeners need to do is trust us on this one and trust
There's
all
lots
the...
of swearing in it.
Yes, there is lots of very good, very expressive swearing in it. But people should trust us on this one and watch it a few times and start to get to know it. And then when you do that, you'll find that the lines stick in your head. It's very sticky, the script. Maybe it's not... We know it's not for everyone, right? It's not for everyone, but there are certain types of people who tend to enjoy this film. And I think...
It is an 18...
It's an 18 certificate.
It's an 18 certificate that does contain. Well, you should wrap up with the swearathon.
Yeah, I will.
Because it also summarizes the plot.
I will.
It's a way you can follow the story through the swearing.
I just wanted to say at the end that because it's a cult film, what kind of people usually like this film? And I've narrowed it down to these people, I think. These are the sorts of people who tend to like Withnail and I. And if you find yourself in this description, then you should watch the film. If this isn't you, then, you know, probably best avoided. But I would say that people who like Withnail and I are usually educated, probably at university. They're normally quite well-read. They've read lots of books and things. They probably like a drink or three. So someone who's, you know, who doesn't mind drinking a bit of booze. Someone who's had some wild times, probably involving lots of drink, maybe staying up late, and possibly the use of certain illicit substances, but not necessarily. People who have a dark sense of humour or a dry sense of humour. People potentially who've experienced moments of darkness or confusion. Also, those people who enjoy very colourful swearing, and also rock and roll music and a sort of dandy dress sense. If you like all that kind of stuff, this is the film for you. If you don't like any of those things, then give it a miss and go and watch something else. I will wrap up with the Swearathon, which is something done on YouTube where all the swearing from Withnal and I has been collected together in about two and a half...
It wasn't just done by a geek on YouTube. It's an official...
It's an official thing. Okay, it was
done... Official thing done for the anniversary DVD release, which I own.
So you can hear all the swearing in the film.
And there's also lots of documentaries about Withnal and I.
Yeah, they're very interesting.
Which explain it much, much better than we have. I mean, yeah. Also, don't expect to like it. The first time you watch it, expect to probably not really enjoy it.
Really selling it well, but after a while,
well, it's not that kind of film that you're instantly going to love it. It's, you need to live with it for a while.
For me, just to wrap up, the film is about certain flawed, tragic characters that you meet in your life who are incredible people and amazing to spend time with, but they ultimately never amount to anything. It's sort of tragic in that way. It's also about excess, and
it is tragic, and there's the best Shakespeare performance potentially of all time.
That's right. There's a fantastic reading of some lines from Shakespeare at the end of the film, which really give it this kind of tragic sense. It's also about sort of excess and hedonism and a sort of selfishness. It's about loss of innocence and having to toughen up in order to get on in the world. And it's also about the end of the 1960s idealism and all that stuff. Guys, thanks for talking to me about Withnail and I. I don't know if we've convinced anyone. We will see in the comments section on the website. Nice to talk to you. Have you drunk more ale since the beginning?
I have of late, but wherefore I know not, lost all my ale.
I thought you were going to do all of it.
I can do all of it.
Do you want to do all of it? Go on.
I have of late, but wherefore I know not, lost all my mirth, forgone all custom of exercise. And indeed it goes so heavily with my disposition that this goodly frame, the earth, seems to me a sterile promontory. This most excellent canopy, the air, look you, this brave overhanging firmament, this majestical roof fretted with golden fire, why, it appears no other thing than a foul, pestilent congregation of vapours. What a piece of work is a man, how noble in reason, how infinite in faculty, in form and moving, how express and admirable, in apprehension, how like a god, in action, how like an angel, the beauty of the world, the paragon of animals, and yet to me, what is this quintessence of dust? Man delights not me, no, nor woman neither, nor woman neither.
Wow, well done. That's the that's a fantastic reading of this famous speech from Hamlet, which is included at the end of the film. Guys, thanks so much for talking to me. Have a good rest of the evening. Okay,
sorry.
No, that was great. I love that reading.
Okay, thanks a lot. Good
thanks,
night.
Thanks, guys.
I have a late, wherefore I know not, lost all my mirth. And indeed, it goes so heavily with my disposition that this goodly frame, the earth, seems to me a sterile promontory.
It's the most excellent canopy, the air. Look you, this brave o'erhanging firmament, this majestical roof fretted with golden fire, why, it appeareth nothing to me but a foul and pestilent congregation of vapours. What a piece of work is a man, how noble in reason, how infinite in faculties, how like an angel in apprehension, how like a god, the beauty of the world, paragon of animals. Yet to me, what is this quintessence of dust? Man delights not me, no, nor women neither, nor women neither.
What you just heard there is the final scene of the film in which Withnail repeats lines from Hamlet by Shakespeare, and it's quite a tragic ending, but you'll have to watch the film to find out what happens. So, that was quite an ambitious episode. I honestly think that this one is just as ambitious as the one that I did about the rules of cricket, which was also very complicated. All the way through that conversation, this one about Withnail and I, alarm bells were ringing in my head. Now, sometimes I get alarm bells when I'm teaching. From experience, I know what my learners of English will and won't understand. For example, if there's a listening that we're doing in class and it contains a few phrasal verbs or connected speech or a specific accent, then the alarm bells ring in my head. And sure enough, none of my students have understood it. So, for this episode, alarm bells are ringing like mad, I have to say. First of all, the film is like this film is like kryptonite to students of English, if you know what I mean. You know, like the way Superman can be destroyed by kryptonite, in a similar way, you can destroy a group of learners of English with this film. It's like sort of kryptonite for learners of English, speaking from experience of showing the film to groups of students from time to time. And that's a pity because there is a lot to enjoy. But these are the reasons why the alarm bells are ringing, because I think it's just a difficult film for learners of English. But also because in this conversation, you've been listening to three guys talking with fairly similar voices in a comfortable way, meaning not graded for learners of English to make it easier. So that's another reason why it might have been difficult for you. And also, we're talking about a film that you've probably never seen. Also, the little clips from the film in particular were, I'm sure, rather difficult to follow. So I understand if this has been a difficult one. And I thought this would be an ambitious episode, okay? This is the sort of thing, the thing we're talking about, and this episode as well, the sort of thing that's difficult when you listen to it the first time, but the more you listen to it, the more rewards you can get from it, and I promise you that. If you now go out and see the film, if you find Withnail and I on the internet or on DVD or something, and you watch it, it might be difficult at first. You know, you can put the subtitles on in English or in your language, but I recommend that you put them on in English, because really this film is all about the script and about the performances of the characters and less about the story. I recommend that you get your hands on this film and watch it. It might be difficult at first, but you could go back to this episode, listen to it again, which might help you to kind of understand more and more. And then you watch the film a second time after having heard this again, and you might find that you kind of crack this film and suddenly you get it and you start to really enjoy it. And it kind of sort of improves your life in a weird way. So I have actually talked about this film on the podcast before. And in fact, I do remember getting a message from a listener who said that she had watched the film on my recommendation with her boyfriend, and that now they enjoy repeating lines from the script when they are around the house. So if they can get into it, then I think that you can too. Although, of course, this film is not for everyone. That's why it's a cult film. Now, I've just remembered I promised to play the Withnail and I swear-a-thon at the end of this episode. A swear-a-thon. That's a bit like a marathon, like a long series of things or a long race or something, like a marathon, but not. It's actually with swearing, so it's a swear-a-thon. Now, Withnail and I is celebrated for its swearing, and there is a lot of colourful, rude language in this film. For the 20th anniversary DVD box set, someone edited together all of the swear words from the film in order. So every single swear word that appears in the film in order, okay? This is the Withnail and I swear-a-thon. Now, as you would expect, the next minute or so is going to be absolutely filled with swearing, okay? So brace yourselves. You're going to hear lots of very rude words, okay? So here we go. Here's the Withnail and I swear-a-thon.
Bloody fuck, fucker,
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 fucks, fucking
bastard,
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 wankers,
wankers,
fucking
puns,
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 balls,
bugger,
puns,
fucker,
puns,
puns, fuck, Bastards. Bastards.
Baggers.
Fucking.
Fucking. Cunt.
This is shit.
Shit.
A fucking shag sack. Balls. Ass. Fuck off.
Piss.
Fucking piss.
Fucking. Fucking bastard.
Fucking bastard.
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 Shit.
Fuck.
Fucking.
Bloody bastard.
Bitch. Asses. Fuck.
Bastard.
Bastard.
Arsehole.
Arsehole.
Arsehole. Brat. Son.
Bastard. Bastard.
Bloody
bastard.
Bloody
piss.
Fucking bastard. Cunt fucking
shat the bugger.
Bollocks and
bloody smelly good
asshole. Balls. Fucking.
Fucking.
Buggers.
Bastard.
Bastard. Bastard. Buggering.
Fucking.
Motherfucker.
Fucking. Piss off.
Bloody.
Fuck. Fuck. Fuck.
So I think that's probably a suitable note on which to end this episode. I very much hope that you've enjoyed listening to this episode of Luke's Film Club on Luke's English Podcast. Check out the page for the episode on the website for some notes, transcriptions, and also a bunch of video documentaries, clips, and interviews that are definitely worth watching if you would like to know more. Thanks for listening and have a great morning, evening, breakfast, lunch, dinner, sleep, commute, or run or drink, whatever it is you're doing. And I'll speak to you again on the podcast soon, but for now it's time to say goodbye. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.
Thanks for listening to Luke's English Podcast. For more information, visit teacherluke.co.uk.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
If you enjoyed this episode of Luke's English Podcast, consider signing up for Luke's English Podcast Premium. You'll get regular premium episodes with stories, vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation teaching from me, and the usual moments of humour and fun. Plus, with your subscription, you will be directly supporting my work and making this whole podcast project possible. For more information about Luke's English Podcast Premium, go to teacherluke.co.uk/premium info.